next case this morning is number 023751, John Stark against PPM America Incorporated. Mr. Campbell.
May it please the court. My name is Michelle Dar Campbell. I represent appellant John Stark on this appeal. There are three substantive issues involved in this appeal. One is whether Mr. Stark is entitled to severance benefits under the change of control severance plan maintained by his employer. The second issue is whether Mr. Stark is entitled to a bonus for the last year in which he worked, which was the year 2000. The third issue is whether the district court below erred in awarding attorney fees to the defendants in the matter based on an issue of contract interpretation.
I have a question for you that relates to a statement you make on page 4 of your brief. I'll call it the brief on the merits as opposed to the attorney's fee brief in 02-4058, etc., where you say the district court held that a change of control event had, which you italicize, occurred under plan provisions contained in Appendix A and so forth. I would like you to point me to the exact language in the district court's opinion that supports that statement.
I'm looking at the opinion, which is on page 12 of the opinion. The court set forth in that on that page two events that would constitute a change of control, 7 and 9, both of which Mr. Stark had argued constituted a change of control event. Two paragraphs down from that, after describing the sale of PPM A to Holborn Delaware Partnership, the court states that the parties agreed that the transfer of the shares down from Prudential PLC falls squarely within the subsection 7 description.
All right. Now, so he says the parties agree. I thought that might be the sentence you were thinking about. And when the court reports an agreement of the parties, that's not the same thing as the judicial holding that that agreement represents anything. It's like a stipulation. The court doesn't need to resolve a fact if the parties have stipulated as to that fact. The parties agree, and then he goes on to say where the parties diverge is on who's now the ultimate parent, and that's when he goes off into this discussion about corporations that you've addressed in your brief. But I have to say, I don't see language where a court says the parties agree that X is the case, the same thing as a judicial holding that X is the case.
I believe the court went through the analysis in the paragraph before as to what number 7 states. And then I would read it as the court looking at the transaction and itself agreeing also with a perceived agreement with the parties.
Well, the court describes in the paragraph before, the plan defines an employer as including PPMA, the ultimate parent means the uppermost parent corporation, and then there's the caveat. So he lays out various parts of the plan, but he isn't, I just can't look at that and find a holding that this particular transaction that you're now focusing on, the transfer to the Holborn Delaware Partnership, and then the ultimate transfer down to Brook, equals a subpart 7 sale or other disposition by the ultimate parent, since, of course, number 1, the ultimate parent never sold or disposed of anything. But be that as it may, I just can't see this section of the opinion as a holding. And so to describe it as such, I would say at best is misleading in the brief.
I apologize if it was misleading. It was our understanding that the court properly applied 7. And Your Honor mentioned, I believe, an argument that appellees make in their opposing brief that Prudential did not dispose of the company.
But the original ultimate parent never changes. They're at the top of this corporate change, even though it gets filtered through a partnership that three wholly owned companies have created.
immediately in my reading of what they submitted below in terms of their motion for summary judgment and describing the transactions, immediately before the sales, what we call PPM UK, which has been the parent above PPM Holdings, sold its interest to Prudential. So Prudential did, in December of 1999, wholly own the shares of Holdings. So it did dispose of the shares. That's in the record below.
Well, it depends what you think of. I mean, there's some actually very useful charts in the appendix, in the actual record, as opposed to the appendix to the brief, where you've got Prudential PLC above all of these various other companies. And as of 1999, you get Prudential Corporate Holdings Limited, then you get the partnership entering the chain, and then you get eventually Brook Holdings entering the chain. PPM Holdings itself, Inc., never changes. PPM America never changes. And so all you have is sort of shuffling in the middle going on.
That's correct, but I was responding to the claim that they made that Prudential never directed the sale when Prudential did. I don't have it in this chart. That's because the chart that we put in was showing the structural lines pre-December 1999. The chart that they have put in skips a process by which PPM UK sold its shares directly up to Prudential in December, and thereafter Prudential dispensed of its holdings of PPM Holdings. So it did sell.
Well, it didn't. This is the issue we'll need to consider, but when Prudential PLC, which at all times is at the top of this chain, it's just that it filters through the partnership at one level, through Prudential 1 Limited, 80%, Prudential 2 Limited, 10%, Prudential 3 Limited, 10%. And those three companies, through their partnership, convey to Brook Holdings, which is 100% owned. That the question is, has Prudential PLC ever changed?
I believe that the issue is whether under the plan, the definition of ultimate parent continued to suggest or to state that Prudential did continue to be the ultimate parent. I believe that that is what's controlling here is the terms of the definition of ultimate parent, which does describe ownership as requiring that it be through a chain of ownership of corporations. When it was sold to the partnership, it was no longer under this plan term. I understand that outside the plan there may be different understandings of what ultimate parent means, but it is described and defined in this plan.
What do you think directly or indirectly owns PPM Holdings means?
The ultimate parent? When it says the ultimate parent,
it's on page 12, ultimate parent means the uppermost parent corporation which directly or indirectly owns PPM Holdings.
I believe that it has to nonetheless be through a chain of ownership of corporations.
What's indirect ownership then?
Indirect ownership would be off to, if you look at the corporate structure, off to the side, the top side. That would be indirectly. It's not in a direct chain of companies. Nonetheless, it must be a direct chain of corporations. I think corporation is a very critical term. I noticed that in preparing for argument that this court in its disclosure statement doesn't request the disclosures of parent partnerships. It requests disclosures of parent corporations. It's not just a sum over substance type of argument. And the partnership existed long before the change of control plan was put into existence. And looking at the disclosure statement actually put in by Appalese, I note that Holborn Delaware partnership is no longer a partnership, it's a corporation. So they themselves changed the entity thereafter. But that is our argument on the severance benefits, is that if the court applies the terms of the plan as written, therefore Mr. Stark is clearly entitled to benefits under this plan.
Well, he's not clearly entitled. It just means you would get to explore whether he was removed for cause and whether a number of other eventualities happened. It's just he'd get over a hurdle.
I believe that the appellees have waived the right to argue that he was terminated for cause. They have 60 days after the determination that there was a for-cause event.
But he never asked for the benefits. I mean, you have this big exhaustion problem, too, which, regardless of how the district court resolved it, was something that was certainly argued before the district court, and thus it's something that this court can consider. He never said, I'm invoking my rights under the change of control severance plan, and I would like to have this before he filed his lawsuit. He says, oh, you can take my second amended complaint as though it were a request for benefits. But he never asks, and thus all of these other things that get triggered in terms of time limits for responding to a request are, at the very best, thrown off whack.
I believe that the plan itself does not connect the requirement that you set forth a written notice to exhaustion.
How do you know, I mean, how's the plan supposed to know when the 60 days starts running if he never asked?
It's the 60 days from the event that constitutes cause. It's independent of
the... So he has to wait for 15 years to ask for plans, but there it stops when he doesn't ask for benefits? They have to, like, send out a preemptive letter to everybody 60 days after the change of control, saying, just in case you someday decide to ask for benefits, we're saying something about you. I mean, it's a very weird system you're talking about.
In connection with the... I believe, though, that the plan does state that you have to send out a notice for cause. And Mr. Stark sent out his notice for terminating his employment for good reason. In this case, and we didn't re-argue the futility argument, but the very people who set forth this whole way of terminating Mr. Stark in order to not trigger the key man provisions in the plans that he managed, he believed would also deny his claim in the same fashion. These are the same people who took over within 1 month determined to fire him after 10 years. And if the court has no more questions on severance, I'd like to briefly address the bonus issue. There was a 10-year practice of paying a bonus to Mr. Stark and others. Each of the 10 years he worked there, he received at least 95% of his bonus potential. There's a bonus potential and there's something called a bonus target, which is 2/3 of the bonus. And that is the floor that is reflected by testimony from Mr. Stark. It's also reflected in the plan itself when determining severance benefits. It looks to severance benefits as a component of his compensation, which is bonus and salary. And the bonus is determined as a minimum of his target, which the plan says is 2/3.
Why does the plan govern his bonus since the bonus isn't being paid under the plan? You're saying that the bonus is part of his basic employment relationship. So I don't see what the plan has to do, plus or minus.
It's corroboration.
Back to the bone.
Well, so I believe corroboration of his testimony to show that Mr. Stark said 2/3 was the bottom line, and the plan reflects that. I'm not saying that the plan governs. I'm just showing corroboration.
Okay, you agree. He's not being paid under the plan.
No, really. He's not. It's just corroboration of his 2/3. In addition, all of the plans, severance agreements produced by defendants in connection with the people who were fired in the year 2000, each one of those people received a bonus for that year. The only evidence that they put forth is evidence of people who were fired after Mr. Stark left. I don't believe that's relevant. The testimony by the new president, who had been president for 1 month, as to what happened over the course of 10 years, I believe is not relevant. I think that what is relevant is what happened during those 10 years, which is an unwavering course of conduct whereby Mr. Stark was paid a bonus totaling 2/3 of compensation. Briefly, in connection with attorney's fees, I don't believe there's a case law out there setting forth that you can award attorney's fees to an ERISA plaintiff on a contract interpretation. The court did it on the fact that Brooke Holdings was not identified in the original complaint. However, in the original complaint, Mr. Stark describes and quotes another change of control event, which is number 9, under which he was then proceeding and continued to proceed as the court stated down below. And so he clearly, in his March complaint, set forth a cause of action under the plan, quotes from the plan, a change of control event, and thereafter added to that by disclosing the Brooke Holdings Company transaction 2 months later. I'd like to say the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. We'll hear now from Mr. Banks.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Banks for the appellees, defendants, PPM America, and the plan. There are, as Ms. Dark-Campbell noted, three sets of issues. Unless the court would prefer that I turn to one before the other, I would begin in the same order as Ms. Dark-Campbell, starting with the claim for change of control severance benefits. The court relied, as Judge Wood noted, on one particular provision. There are other hurdles that Mr. Stark would have to overcome, even if he could get by that one, before he would be entitled to benefits. But to turn to the one that Judge Hibbler and Judge Darrah addressed below, that deals with the question of whether there was a change of control, and specifically whether Prudential PLC remained the ultimate parent of the company. Mr. Stark has attempted to argue that that is not the case, that Prudential did not remain the ultimate parent, and he's pointed to the definition contained in the plan. Having read the plaintiff's brief and having just listened to Ms. Dark-Campbell's argument, I think there is a misrepresentation here that I suspect is inadvertent. On page 36 of the appellant's brief, there's a quote from the operative language of the plan that is flat out wrong. It deals with this chain of ownership question. As you'll recall, Ms. Dark-Campbell referenced to this court that in looking at whether Prudential PLC remains the ultimate parent, we must look at the chain of ownership. And she described it, Ms. Dark-Campbell described it, as a chain of ownership of corporations. If we look at the third line from the bottom of page 36, there's a reference to the definition of uppermost parent corporation. And then in quotes on that line, it uses the phrase, a chain of corporations, and the word corporations is italicized. That is not the language of the plan in any way, shape, or form. It's not the operative language, and it's not an accurate quote. The accurate quote appears in the plan, which is Exhibit 5 attached to appellant's brief.
You're looking at page A12.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Right.
Ultimate parent, and then it gives a definition, means the uppermost parent corporation, which is the prior phrase Ms. Dark-Campbell uses in her brief in quotes, which directly or indirectly owns PPM Holdings through a chain of ownership, not a chain of corporations, not a chain of ownership of corporations, but a chain of ownership where each parent corporation owns at least 50% of the voting power of the immediately lower tier subsidiary. In other words, to the extent that that chain of ownership is comprised of corporations, every entity in that chain must own 50% or more of the immediately lower tier subsidiary. And that is what we have here. It does not say in here that if a series of Prudential subsidiaries combine to form a partnership or a limited liability company or some other entity, but still corporations that take a slightly different form to own a subsidiary, that that somehow breaks a chain.
Of course, subsidiary is defined to mean corporation or limited liability company, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it doesn't encompass partnerships in that definition.
That's right. To the extent you have a parent corporation and a subsidiary corporation, there must be at least 50% ownership, but it does not preclude what we have here, which is a combination of three entities to form a partnership within the same chain. It does not say that each entity in the chain of ownership must be a corporation. And after all, that is consistent with common sense and the purpose of change of control plans. This plan, in a common sense way, said that if ownership is broken and an outsider is thrown into the chain, then that might be deemed a change of control. That is simply not what we have here. There are other alternative grounds that the district court did not need to cite to enter summary judgment on behalf of the defendants. Judge Wood, you alluded to some briefly in referring to the circumstances of Mr. Stark's separation and whether there was cause for his termination. I submit that it's actually much more of an obstacle for him than that. Mr. Stark was removed from his position as a key officer in early December 2000. The president of the company and others concluded that Mr. Stark had been grossly insubordinate, that he had tried to delay the disclosure of millions of dollars of losses, and that he had fomented dissent among his key staff. And pending later determination of how his employment would be resolved, he was removed from officer status. But he remained an employee, and he collected his full salary. Then abruptly, in the first week of January 2001, he resigned.
Well, don't, at this posture of the case, though, whether or not you would at some later point contest that, don't we have to assume this was a constructive discharge, which is what he asserts that it was?
I don't believe so, Judge Wood. The constructive discharge concept applies in, for example, Title VII and age discrimination and other state discrimination laws as an equitable concept to deal with a scenario where an individual is terminated, or excuse me, not terminated, but subjected to oppressive working conditions or such a change in status that a reasonable person would feel constrained to resign. Here we're dealing with something very different. We're dealing with a plan that determines precisely when a resignation qualifies one for benefits. This plan does allow a participant to resign for good reason, not constructive discharge standard, but good reason as defined. However, to qualify for benefits, that resignation for good reason must be preceded by a notice from the participant to the employer. This is all spelled out in the definitions of the plan. The participant must write to the employer and give the employer 60 days notice, and it says in
here... This is basically part of your exhaustion requirement, or argument, isn't it? I mean, he's called on the carpet on December 5th of 2000. He's basically told your history, but we'll find a way to ease you out, and of course he doesn't take that offer, and I guess it gets revoked shortly thereafter. But it seems to me the real problem is that he doesn't follow the script that the plan sets out, whether it's for this good reason or whether it's asking for his benefits.
Well, it's related, Your Honor, but it's not the same. There is a claims procedure. In other words, if Stark had been terminated or if he had resigned for good reason and followed the procedures and then believed he was entitled to severance benefits, there was a specific claims procedure embodied in the plan that he was required to follow. That's step two. Step one, though, is on a resignation as opposed to a termination, there are steps that he must have complied with. It says on page A8 of the plan, again the same tab 5, that before a resignation for good reason is deemed to take effect, the participant must submit a notice to the employer that he or she intends to resign for good reason. The employer must have 60 days to cure, and this is the key. The termination must specify, the resignation or notice must specify the provision under the plan that the employee is relying on. Mr. Stark did not do that. Had he submitted a notice to PPMA, he could have said, it's now January the 8th, I wish to resign. You're stripping my positions as a corporate officer, has altered my condition so deleteriously that I consider this good reason, and I believe I am entitled to change of control severance benefits, citing a provision in the plan. The employer then would have had a choice. Does it restore him as a corporate officer, or does it allow him to go and then either pay the benefits or contest the benefits? This is yet another way in which Mr. Stark failed to satisfy a condition precedent in the plan. The question of whether there was cause and whether he jumped the gun in resigning, I agree, is a factual dispute that would have to be decided if this court otherwise finds that there was a change of control. Unless the court has further questions on the severance issue, I would like to turn to the bonus, if I may. There really should be no dispute here that this was a discretionary bonus. Mr. Stark points to nothing. No promise in person, no promise over the telephone, no writing, nothing evidencing a bonus.
And it's your position that course of conduct on the part of the employer can never give rise to an inference that it's the employer's intent to make this a right as opposed to a privilege, if you will?
I would not say never, Your Honor, but as the panel noted in the Brines case last year, in which you joined Judge Wood, practice alone does not create a contract. Practice may help to explain a contract. There may be some cases where a practice is so pervasive and so clear that it evidences a meeting of the minds. But we don't have that here for several reasons. First, Mr. Stark did not receive a full bonus in several of the years in question. Admittedly, he received about 95% of his target.
And Mr. Campbell is now arguing that there was some minimum of two-thirds. I actually don't remember reading that in the briefs, but...
Well, I don't remember reading it in the record other than in Mr. Stark's allegations. There's no support for that. In fact, in the year in which Mr. Stark's employment ended, there were several people who similarly received no bonus. There were other situations in which people received over the years less than two-thirds bonus. That was an allegation or conclusory statement made by Mr. Stark, but he didn't identify individuals or circumstances supporting that, and we identified to the contrary. Furthermore, not only is there no promise that he's identified or writing that he's identified, but we have Mr. Stark's own email in which he refers to his bonus as discretionary, and Mr. Stark writing to his subordinates in 2000 bemoaning the fact that the new superior, Mr. Saltzman, who had oversight authority over PPMA, had refused to guarantee minimum levels of compensation. So, if anything, the practice here suggests a discretionary bonus, one that's frequently paid. I don't mean to belittle the bonus as a part of Mr. Stark's compensation at all. It's a significant piece. And perhaps this comparison is unfair because one might view it that way. I give my 17-year-old son an allowance every week. I have for the last 2 years because he's earned it.
Unless you're a very generous man, I think this is maybe not the best analogy. But
the fact that bonuses are given routinely doesn't mean that I give away the discretion to exercise my judgment, nor did PPMA give away its discretion to exercise its judgment when circumstances were different given the conduct that resulted in Mr. Stark's removal. As for the attorney's fee provision, I know Ms. Darkhamble has suggested in oral argument and in her brief that it is rare that a participant has a fee award entered against him or her. I agree that it is less customary that a participant has fees awarded. But I believe, again, this court discussed that, Your Honor, Judge Wood discussed that in the Hess case in 2001, noting that there is a modest presumption favoring the prevailing party, and that what it really comes down to is whether the position taken by the participant was substantially justified.
Your clients are all three of these entities, right? PPMA, yes. PPMH, and the plan itself?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, I won't reiterate all the shortcomings in Mr. Stark's claim for change of control severance benefits, but I would point out it was not one district judge, but two district judges who found this not to be substantially justified. One, Judge Dara, decided that defendants would be entitled to attorney's fees, and Judge Hibbler reiterated Judge Dara's conclusions about the lack of substantial justification in awarding the amount of fees. When Judge Hibbler was out ill, the case briefly was handled by Judge Dara. I think our briefs speak to that, and unless the court has any further questions, I would rest on the briefs. I thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Banks. You have 6 minutes, Mr. Campbell. You have 6 minutes.
I would first like to reply to Appley's description of the reason that Mr. Stark was fired in December. I know this is not on appeal. However, each of the criticisms that were levied against Mr. Stark dealt with the way he communicated to the new management. who's been in there for about a year. He had communicated this way all the way through 10 years. He was criticized about how much information he was or was not giving to Jackson National Life Insurance Company, which is set forth in our brief, is one of the reasons for the severance plan. They did not want to have to report to their client. In fact, the issue about the losses, yes, in the year 2000, Mr. Stark's funds didn't do too well. A lot of funds didn't do too well. He didn't just have Jackson as an investor. He had other private investors who were investors in his funds as well. The information about the funds were on a website. The funds didn't do well. The notice of this went out to all the investors, and Jackson went crazy because they didn't get a call beforehand. They didn't get the heads up. They didn't get preferential treatment as Mr. Stark's employer after the year 2000. They learned like, quote, every other investor. Mr. Stark was put between a rock and a hard place on that. You have your duties as a fiduciary to treat everyone equally, and then you have the fact that you have this new boss. So that's everything that they criticized was related to that.
Well, Jackson wasn't their new boss, really. I mean, they are in there in the chain, but actually I think that, too, is not quite an accurate description of what this chain looks like. There are some overlapping corporate executives, which happens not uncommonly with complex organizations.
Holborn and Brooke Holdings had been, for years, the holding company of Jackson.
Right. The clients may be their sisters, if you will, but they aren't owned by Jackson. It's the other way around.
All their high-level executives were on the boards of Brooke and Holborn. The president of J&L, after the transaction, became the president not only of J&L, but also headed up PPM America.
Right, but that doesn't mean that there's corporate ownership. I mean, in fact, what you're arguing for is that the severance plan covers changes of management as opposed to change of control, because any corporation could put a new president in or could put a new chief executive officer of some type in.
I agree with that. However, I think that in the changes that happened internally, I will give you, actually the end result was that PPMA was put under already existing structure that had managed J&L. But the other thing I wanted to get to, too, is in terms of internal transactions. Appellees have argued, and I believe the court below also was persuaded by, the fact that it said that the plan does not include internal reorganizations as a trigger. There's no such exclusion in this plan. However, there are certain events listed among the 9 changes of control events in the plan which do exclude internal transactions. For example, number 5 says if there's a merger, it's a change of control event, unless it's with somebody internal or a subsidiary. The fact that that's not also in number 7 leads me to believe, and also with the plan states, that there is no such internal reorganization exclusion to benefit. They could have put that in. They didn't put that in. And I say that they are bound by the terms of the plan as written. They wrote them. This is how the plan is should be interpreted. The other statement I wanted to make, too, is in terms of the bonus. All of the severance plans that were produced by defendants in this case for people who were terminated in the year 2000, everyone there got a bonus. So I don't understand where all this evidence is out there. I haven't seen it, that people did not get a bonus over the course of the years that Mr. Stark was employed. It's not here. If it were here, obviously, we would have a different claim. With the two-thirds as a target, as the bottom, that comes from 2 pieces of evidence which are in the record. One is Mr. Stark's own testimony.
Did you argue this in your brief?
I believe it's in there, the two-thirds.
The two-thirds? I'll go back and look at it. Don't worry about it. But it
could be. I know we argued that the plan itself, it attaches appendix, and it talks about bonus potential, which is 270%. It also has, and it's attached to the appendix in support of our motion for summary judgment, but it also has bonus targets, and it says two-thirds of bonus potential. And whereas I agree that he's not entitled to it under the plan, a bonus, it just corroborates his testimony. With the exhaustion, we fully have briefed that. The court excused it. This is an ERISA plan. That's true. Exhaustion is not mandated by ERISA. It's within the discretion of the court, especially in this kind of case where it's de novo review. It's not, for example, a claim for disability benefits for the discretionary review, and it's important that the administrator get all the information from the doctors, review all the evidence to make a determination, which is then reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. Here, the only issues were, here's the plan, here's a transaction, is it triggered? The court was amply able, although we disagree with the results, but amply able to review those issues and determine that, in fact, Mr. Clark was or was not entitled to severance benefits. We believe that decision was incorrect, as we do with respect to the attorneys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Campbell, I noticed that there has been a firm affiliation change, both in your case and with respect to the Mr. Johnson and Mr. Sheffers. Are your disclosure statements up to date with respect to that?
What happened is, not my firm is Moran Dar Campbell in New York, but in Chicago, Mr. Schaefer, the name of the firm was Dancona, and then it merged with Safar. I believe that you filed the requisite.
I see. Well, if both of you would just check to make sure your disclosure statements are up to date, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.